Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Ben Ryland. On this week's film review, we have shark attacks, supervillains, and one of punk's most famous love stories gone awry. It sounds like an eventful weekend at the cinema, so to make sense of it all, we've summoned film critic for The Telegraph, Tim Robey, into the studio. Welcome to the show, Tim.
Hi.
To begin today, we're in the shallows, where a surfing Blake Lively is up against the ocean's greatest predator and perhaps the most terrifying one as well, the great white shark. Tim, on the surface, this looks like it could be a terrible B-movie bikini thriller, but it's won mostly positive reviews. Why do you think that is?
Well, if you think back to Jaws, I imagine people said much the same thing about Jaws.
It's precisely.
Like, how good can it be? You know, it's a shark attacking people. And in fact, this film begins a little bit like Jaws begins, with just, you know, a lone female in the water. She's been surfing, but then she's left out on her own, and the shark closes in for the kill. For me, it's quite an example of quite ingenious direction rescuing a pretty silly concept, because on a script level, it really isn't doing anything new, and in fact, it's quite cheesy. The stuff about her kind of mum dying of cancer and having being a fighter, and she has to become a fighter as well because her mum was a fighter, and it's just like must we? But what rescues it is the kind of the novelty and the kind of creativity of the direction. I think the camera gets right in there, and there's some really quite good effects as well, which I think a shark film needs these days. I think back to Deep Blue Sea from the 1990s, which is an extremely entertaining but completely terrible film effects-wise. Absolutely terrible. And no credibility for a second. And this actually really, now, they're able to kind of do it on a modest budget. They're able to kind of make the shark look pretty convincing.
It sort of sums up what B-movies are supposed to be all about. Back when the B-movie concept really did actually exist, you had the limited budget, but it's obviously where a lot of the most talented filmmakers came from, because they could work so ingeniously within these very, very limited means.
Yeah, and it's also definitely working that kind of niche of having basically one actor stranded for most of the film, a la, you know, Sandra Bullock in Gravity, or Ryan Reynolds in Buried was another one, just kind of sticking to one character. The only downside of that is that there are a few other minor characters who we see in the trailer, and we actually see what happens to them in the trailer. So that's rather giving the game away for anyone who's seen it. I would recommend seeing this film without seeing the trailer first, because there's a bit more suspense held back if you do that.
So what do we think of Blake Lively's performance in this one? She's been a little bit hit and miss with her takeover of the multiplexes. She came, of course, from Gossip Girl, took a bit of a detour with the quite terrible Green Lantern movie with Ryan Reynolds. Where is she at now with this one?
I'm still waiting to find a Blake Lively performance that I really like. I don't think this is quite it, actually. She's absolutely fine, and she's certainly... she's not helped by the script, let me put it that way, and she manages to kind of give a tolerable kind of competent performance despite that. But it's not the kind of like revelation that you might expect it to be, given that the whole film rests on her shoulders. She's, I think, maybe slightly misdirected sometimes. I remember her trying to do a kind of big acting routine in Ben Affleck's The Town, where she plays a kind of sort of duplicitous sort of semi-prostitute character, and she was trying to be a bit gritty in that, and it didn't quite work. I don't know whether she just kind of needs to go back to acting class and have another go. She's not quite there yet for me, I don't think. Perhaps it's just the role. It's just the role that she's waiting for that we need. We need her to kind of come up with a Julia Roberts style kind of vehicle that will actually really kind of win her over to film audiences. I mean, this film has done well, and I think it won't hurt her at all. But it's really not her that's the attraction in the way. It's the shark.
Celebrity versus actress, perhaps. Before we go any further, though, let's hear a bit of a clip of The Shallows.
What did you say the name of this place was?
This is paradise.
Well, we can only assume whatever's going on there is quite indeed horrifying and quite terrifying. Tim, you mentioned there that a lot of the pleasures to be had from The Shallows comes from the direction. Now, the director here actually made his debut about a decade ago with that quite atrocious remake of the Vincent Price classic House of Wax, starring Paris Hilton. Hilton. It would seem as though he's not really aiming to graduate from B-movies then if he's doing this 10 years later.
He's unashamedly a B-movie maestro, actually.
His name's
Haume Colet-Serrat, and he made a very, very entertaining Liam Neeson movie called Unknown, which was extremely silly. He does seem to like casting blonde ingenues, because January Jones was in that one, and of course Paris Hilton was in House of Wax, and now we have Blake Lively. He casts kind of appealing young actresses in schlock, essentially. And he casts people like Liam Neeson, who we know can kind of just do his bit, his routine. I think he also directed Non-Stop, the Liam Neeson on a plane movie, which actually was, again, quite crafty within its very, very generic kind of limits. I'm basically all for it, because I think at the end of this film, he pulls off a sequence with Blake versus Shark, essentially, which you don't see coming, which is quite elaborately set up and really works. And the audience were kind of gasping at the end of it. I think he has that kind of, you're never going to call him the new Hitchcock, but he has that kind of Roger Corman kind of mentality where you kind of know what you're doing with your limited resources and you know how to kind of give the audience a good ride. So I'm quite in favour of him.
Well, it's quite clearly you weren't bored in the cinema then, so that is always a very good thing. The Shallows is rolling out in cinemas around the world throughout summer, and we recommend that you don't watch it just before heading off on holiday, of course. Next up, we have a bunch of unlikely heroes who have just been called upon to save the world. Suicide Squad is the latest from DC Comics. It's hitting cinemas and see some of our favourite supervillains joining forces under the watchful eye of a secret government agency aiming to save the world from a powerful threat. Here's a bit of a clip.
Goodbye, everybody. Deadshot. Guy shoots people. He's a crocodile. And he eats people. Burns people. You're possessed by a witch. And she's just crazy.
What was that? I should kill everyone and escape? Sorry. The voices. I'm kidding. That's not what they really said.
This is the deal. You're going somewhere very bad.
Whoa!
To do something that'll get you killed. So save the world.
Suicide Squad there. Tim, I hate to venture into that tiresome game of Marvel versus DC Comics, but come on, listening to that trailer, the use of some old classic tracks there, the comparisons to Guardians of the Galaxy, they're inevitable.
They are, unfortunately. I mean, not only are this gang of anti-heroes, supervillain characters being relied upon to save the world in this film, they're being relied upon to save the Warner Brothers DC comic brand, really, from the terrible time they're having, because Batman v Superman was terrible.
I mean, that's a tough job to put in the hands of a bunch of supervillains, isn't it?
It is. And what they want this to be is the kind of scrappy, irreverent alternative to the slightly dour, humorless DC universe, in the same way that Guardians of the Galaxy was the kind of we don't really care so much. We're scrappy and on the fly, and we're not locked into the kind of Marvel Uber world. That was what's quite refreshing about that film. But unfortunately, Marvel got there first, and they did it a lot more entertainingly and with a lot more like successful humor. There's a lot of unsuccessful humor in this film, which I think really doesn't help it.
Worst crime you can really have, isn't it? Unsuccessful humor. You make your audience uncomfortable, and there's really no recovery from there.
There's a lot of discomfort in it, and you can see that the film just bears the scars of a massive re-edit and a significant reshoot. I think they threw in another $10 million to kind of reshoot bits and bobs
Because I know that we when Batman vs. Superman came out, as you said, it was absolutely intolerably bad. And then we had the Justice League movie was still gestating at that point. Now, when that trailer came out at one of the Comic Cons recently, it seemed as though the tone had been changed quite significantly to make it lighter, less serious, a little bit more fun. The reshoots that we've seen here in Suicide Squad, has that been because they realised that the tone just wasn't working? We need to have a little bit more fun.
I think that's absolutely right. Yeah, and I think some of the decisions they've made to try and salvage it help it a little bit. It does have a slightly more kind of followable, kind of linear storyline than Batman v Superman did, but it also sacrifices things like Jared Leto's Joker, who was sort of, when we saw the trailers, we thought, oh, he's the main villain here, really barely in it. It's remarkable how little he's in the film. He's mainly confined to flashbacks, and he just pops up occasionally. And instead, we have probably the worst performance in the film, unfortunately, Cara Delevingne as the Enchantress, who just kind of spends her whole time swamped in effect, doing kind of weird dances, and while the others just kind of line up to try and get at her. And even among the kind of main characters, as it were, the Suicide Squad themselves, you vary from kind of Margot Robbie, who's having a pretty good time, actually. And I think that the publicity campaign is rightly focused on her because she kind of actually carries it as best she can.
Well, her character, Harley Quinn, was one of the main successes to come out of that Batman animated series back in the 90s. Mm-hmm. So that character has been around for a long time, and it's always had good reviews. You know, back in the 90s, respected critics were looking at this series and saying, wow, this is some really good writing here. It's surprising it took this long for DC to pick up on that and make something more out of it.
It's true, and we are waiting for the kind of female comic book hero to really kind of blow us away, and there are, you know, signs that that's going to happen with Wonder Woman and with Captain Marvel as well. And as we were talking about Blake Lively and waiting for the kind of performance that really kind of wins you round, I'm coming around to Margot Robbie. I think she's actually getting better and better. I liked her. She was actually the only thing that I liked in that Tarzan film. And I think she's the best thing in this. Will Smith's doing fine in this film too. It's just that a lot of the other minor characters in the squad are just completely undercharacterized and you don't care about them at all. So they're just along for the ride and they're given kind of precisely. There's the Australian one who's called Captain Boomerang. And there's and there's the one who's a kind of big crocodile creature and you don't even recognize the actor underneath. It's very kind of sketchy, and it's just trying to coast on attitude, and the attitude actually gets quite annoying. I would say it's not as bad as Batman v Superman, partly because it comes in under the 2-hour mark, thank goodness, because you really couldn't handle much more of it.
No. We need to move on, but just quickly, you mentioned there that the Wonder Woman movie, of course, is in the works. We've just recently seen a trailer come along. What are your hopes that maybe we could see that movie improve upon the tone and maybe pick up where Suicide Squad has really not done so well?
Yeah, I feel as though they've hit a nadir this summer and that they're going to work pretty hard to pull out of it. And actually, in the kind of cycle of things, they're due a comeback, and it will happen sooner or later. That they'll find a film that everyone will say, ah, here we go. This is what we wanted you to be doing all along. But they will be re-editing and worrying about that a lot. The other problem with Wonder Woman, the hurdle it faces, is that the female-led superhero movies traditionally have just done so badly. If you think back to Catwoman, the Halle Berry film, and Elektra with Jennifer Garner.
Well, both of those movies were undeniably terrible.
Dismal flops. It's just that, why is it that those are the really terrible examples? It feels as though they haven't put enough effort into making those characters work.
Oh, absolutely.
They need to really kind of knock this one out of the park, I think.
Yeah, I mean, those movies were terrible. To be fair, the trailer for Wonder Woman does make it look quite astonishingly good, but of course it's easy to make a good trailer. Suicide Squad is out in cinemas around the world today. Finally, if the new releases don't take your fancy, then this weekend, perhaps the re-release of Alex Cox's biopic Sid and Nancy, which follows the tumultuous relationship of the Sex Pistols bassist Sid Vicious and his girlfriend Nancy Spungen. It's 30 years since the film's debut. Tim, why do you think that this film became such a cult classic?
I think it's the subject and it's the breakthrough performance of Gary Oldman very significantly. But there's actually a lot to be said for how well the film stands up in general. It's tremendously well directed, this film. Alex Cox really had only one hit to his name before this, which was Repo Man, which was a big cult success. And off the back of it, he was given, for the day, a quite significant budget to make this film, about £2.5 million. And he decided to cast Gary Oldman, who was only known in the theatre at that point. Oldman's Vicious is really, really good. I mean, he's very convincing, but he's also just it's announcing Gary Oldman's kind of acting to the world as well. I mean, he's got that kind of insolence and that kind of aggro and that energy that we want from a Gary Oldman performance. And this was really the first film that channeled it well. It was the next year that he played Joe Orton in Prick Up Your Ears, and then he kind of moved to Hollywood. So I think it hinges on him in a lot of ways. Chloe Webb, who plays Nancy, has kind of become more of a TV actress over the years, and she's often kind of in that Where Are They Now file. But I think she's actually really good in it too. And Cox knew what he was doing in casting them together. Their chemistry in this film is excellent. And they're often kind of, they fall in together, these two characters. It's not like a passion for the ages. It's two characters who are kind of mutually dependent and who fall into addiction together, and they find themselves kind of trapped with each other. That's what the story's about. But there are moments of real lyricism as well, I think, and it does, as a punk movie, it has a real kind of beauty to it, which is unusual. Roger Deakins shot the film. This was, the famous cinematographer who's now worked with the Coen brothers about a dozen times. But this was about his sort of fourth or fifth film. He shot it. Looks like $1 million. It looks so good, this film. It's stands up beautifully. He's masterminded the restoration himself. There's one particular scene in an alleyway where the two of them are kissing in slow motion, and there's just rubbish falling out of the windows all around them. And it is wonderful. It's kind of like one of the real iconic images of English cinema, I think, in the 1980s.
Of course, this is the 30th anniversary release, and it's always interesting to look back on films like this that you might remember as existing in a certain period, and then to watch it on the big screen in today's context. It can really change the way that you see the film and the way you respond to a lot of what's being said in the film. How was that experience for you?
Yeah, it absolutely holds up very interestingly, in part because of a lot of the other little faces that pop up in it. You know, you see kind of early turns from the likes of Kathy Burke, for instance. Courtney Love is in the film quite a lot. And there are lots of other kind of English faces that pop up and who we now have seen in other contexts. But Alex Cox kind of knew how to put them all together on set and kind of harness the energy. It was a crazy, crazy bunch of people working on this film together. And they shot about half of it in America as well, and did some brilliant location shooting in New York. They had to find, you know, places in New York and London in 1986 that looked like the late 70s sort of punk scene. And they did really well with that, actually. So it stands up as kind of a document of that, of those kind of buildings and that era as well.
Well, Sid and Nancy is showing in cinemas around the United Kingdom, and for everyone else, you can watch it on DVD or, of course, just stream it. Well, that brings us to the end of today's program. Thanks to Tim Robey. You've been listening to The Monocle Arts Review with me, Ben Ryland. My producer was Holly Fisher. Join us again at the same time on Monday when we'll be joined by the art newspaper's Jane Morris. But for now, thanks for listening and goodbye.